And now for an Active Voices interview on women and the U.S. budget.
You've got a passion. You've got a passion.
This is Active Voices. We discuss new books about our society, from city streets to our own secret worlds. Active Voices, presenting authors who practice what they preach. Today we're speaking with Jane Midgley about her new book, Women and the U.S. Budget, Where the Money Goes and What You Can Do About It. We discuss why more women need to be at the budget bargaining table. Who determines how the federal government collects and spends our money?
Well, this is a huge issue because obviously a lot of what I'm talking about here is what is a democracy. And I don't think we have a fully functioning democracy if we don't really have transparency and accountability in our federal budget and people don't even know what's really happening with it or what the process is. But another, as we've been discussing, but another indicator or question that I'm putting out about do we really have democracy is that women and people of color are really not at the table in the numbers that they need to be for us to really be having a full functioning democracy.
Are we having just token input on these money issues?
I think we really are in a lot of ways, and just one statistic that I think is really important for people to understand. First of all, women are 51% of the population in the U.S., but we're only 13% of the people in Congress. And there's just a couple of women sitting on the Senate Budget Committee, for instance. I don't think that's enough when they're making such unbelievably important decisions. And another thing to remember about this, just to put it in kind of an international perspective, we rank 59th in the world in terms of our representation of women in our national legislature. So I would say in this case we're unbelievably backward. And you would think, you know, often from hearing the media and certain pundits talk that, you know, women are totally liberated and we've achieved everything and we're, you know, we've taken over everything. But I think if we really look at who's making these devastating decisions that have huge impacts, and a lot of the disproportionate impacts are on women and children, then I think we have to have a question about that. And then the other piece is, in this country, 69% of the population is white, but in Congress, 86% of the members of Congress are white. And piece about this, the democracy piece, is that we have a huge proportion of millionaires and multimillionaires.
That's right.
In Congress, particularly in the Senate. Some people now call it the Millionaires Club.
So this makeup of millionaires, this makeup essentially of white millionaires, that's why the budget sort of looks like it's made by white millionaires and why that money trickles down that way. It's not that the country isn't diverse, it's that our representation isn't so diverse.
Totally. And one other point about this is that another thing that they're, as we speak, trying to ram down in through this budget process is making the tax cuts that Bush and company brought as one of their brilliant budget proposals, these gigantic tax breaks for wealthy and corporations. They want to make those tax cuts permanent. In a situation where the country comes up against a huge emergency like we did with the help needed to the victims of Katrina and Rita, that's a time when everything must be on the table, including tax, not just not making the tax cuts permanent, but how about, can I say this, raising taxes perhaps? I mean, we're not even allowed to talk about that.
Jane Midgley's book is Women and the U.S. Budget, Where the Money Goes and What You Can Do About It. She can be found online at womenandtheusbudget.com. East West just rocked together. East West just rocked together. East West just rocked together. Together now. This has been Active Voices from KSFR Studios in Santa Fe, presenting the authors who practice what they preach. I'm Chris Goldstein.
You've got a passion. It's called peace. You've got a passion.
Now, for a little people's history, some of our history to look back on, remember, and be inspired by. Few dates to note coming up this week. On March 8th, International Women's Day, declared in 1976 by the UN as a day for women's rights and international peace. On March 9th, 1986, 100,000 people marched on D.C. for women's reproductive rights. And on March 10th, in 1989, the Human Rights Commission recognized the right to refuse military service as a basic human right. And now we go to the LA Sound Posse for Michael Parenti on Creating the Poor. This is from his series of historical and currently relevant pieces.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, will be released in November 2005. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparenti.org.
Creating the poor. Many compassionate people castigate the very rich and powerful for their lack of concern for the poor. But I've come to the conclusion that the very rich are anything but indifferent to the poor. They are quite mindful of keeping the poor in their place, of having them work as hard as possible for as little as possible. The very rich have a real concern that the working poor do not become too elevated in their collective class condition. Indeed, the owning class sees such a development as threatening to its own vital interests. Throughout the ages, the rich have argued that the poor are the authors of their own poverty. In 17th century England, impoverished people were thought to be the victims of their own, quote, idle, irregular, and wicked courses. Little has changed since then. In 1995, Republican leader Newt Gingrich reduced poverty to a matter of personal inclination. Quote, I am prepared to say to the poor, you have to learn new habits. The habits of being poor don't work, unquote. Meanwhile, Gingrich tirelessly pursued policies to enlarge the ranks of the poor, just as our Republican leadership in the White House and Congress do today. They fight to shift still more of the tax burden onto low and middle income people. They fight to eliminate the minimum wage, to cut spending for public housing, and to abolish school lunches, food stamps, and aid to families with dependent children. They support enormous tax cuts for the corporate rich. They do everything they can to deregulate business activities, downgrade jobs, downsize workforces, and break labor unions. All policies that have led to both deeper and more widespread poverty and greater accumulations of wealth for the super rich. For affluent people, the poor are less than human, demoralized creatures who seem to prefer squalor and misery, freeloaders who live off the rest of us. When they do work, they want to be paid too much for too little effort, according to the super rich. And when they organize into unions, they become troublesome barriers to productivity and prosperity. All this we hear again and again. And yet, you'll find that there's no real mass support in the general American public for the mean-spirited cuts that have been imposed by a Republican Congress and White House. One survey found that 80% of the public felt that society and government had a moral obligation to alleviate poverty. About the same number reject the right-wing argument that poverty is to be blamed on the poor themselves, rather than on the material economic conditions that beset the poor. But thanks to conservative disinformationists who claim that 90% of government anti-poverty funds fail to reach the poor, the public thought the programs were administered with much waste. In fact, the exact opposite is true. Only about 10% of poverty funds are spent on administrative costs, with the rest going to recipients. Another bit of conservative disinformation frequently mouthed by right-wing members of Congress and media commentators is that $5.3 trillion has been spent on welfare in the past 30 years. This bit of fiction is seldom challenged. In fact, the actual figure is less than a tenth of that, about $400 billion in 30 years. $400 billion, what the Pentagon spends in a year. In contrast to right-wing Republicans, those of more liberal persuasion see poverty as a problem created by hard times, substandard schools and housing, deteriorating neighborhoods, a lack of much-needed public programs. If people are poor, it's not because they're lazy and irresponsible. 70% of the families that live in poverty have someone, at least one person, working full-time. If they're poor, it's because they're being paid poverty wages, and they have to pay high prices for things and are burdened with all sorts of regressive taxes. Poverty, then, is a product of the accumulation of wealth. The wealthy need the poor. The wealthy live off the backs of the poor. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed.
You're listening to Making Waves. We now hear from Labor News.
This is Labor News. Information about most of us. You can find us on the internet at labornews.us to listen to archived editions of our program. We receive emails at labornews.podcast@gmail.com. Write to us with comments and ideas. Greed at a glance. On its February 6th edition, the online publication Too Much published its section, A Weekly Update on Avarice in America. Here are a few snippets from that report about amazing examples of greed. Has William McDonough, the first chair of the Federal Accounting Watchdog Agency created after Enron, gone over the dark side? 2 years ago, McDonough called CEO pay grotesquely immoral. Last month, he joined Merrill Lynch as an advisor to CEO E. Stanley O'Neill, who's paid double in 2003 to $28.1 million after the company completed a restructuring that wiped out over 20,000 jobs. O'Neill took home another $32 million in 2004. According to the latest monthly survey of U.S. millionaire households, Americans who hold at least $1 million in investable assets are feeling mildly bullish about the future. Sums up George Wolper, the president of Spectrum Group, the Chicago company that conducts the monthly millionaire polling. Without concerns about surging oil and gas prices holding them back, the nation's wealthiest individuals and families clearly hold a fairly positive view of the investing environment. The federal estate tax, the death tax, to the lawmakers who want to repeal it, will impact the assets of only 6,343 of the 2.3 million people in the United States expected to die this year. In 2006, the estate tax will only kick in on fortunes over $2 million per person, notes United for a Fair Economy, up $500,000 over last year's exemption level. Overall compensation for American workers, wages and benefits, fell 0.3% in 2005, the first annual decrease since 1996. For the year, reports the Commerce Department, Americans spent $42 billion more than they earned, the first time the nation has registered a negative savings rate for an entire year since 1933, near the height of the Great Depression. And the quote of the week from Too Much. Let them eat prescriptions. Quote, a vote for this bill is a vote, literally, to take away from health care for our children so we can give more money to the super rich. End quote. This from Representative Louis Slaughter, a Democrat from New York, during the House debate over a $39.5 billion budget cut package that will, among other things, slash prescription drug aid for poor families on Medicare. The budget cut passed in a 216-214 vote last week. This was Labor News. Information about most of us.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, who discusses the latest wave of sectarian violence in Iraq and the outlook for a withdrawal of large numbers of U.S. troops. Nancy Keenan, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, who assesses a proposed ban against abortion in South Dakota that lawmakers there hope will go before the U.S. Supreme Court. And attorney Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who outlines the criminal violations committed by the president that he believes are grounds for the impeachment of George W. Bush. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Arab Emirates, tangled in a heated dispute over the state-owned Dubai Port World's takeover of terminal operations in major U.S. ports, is also a major buyer of American high-tech weapons. The energy-rich Persian Gulf country has bought 80 state-of-the-art F-16 EF fighter jets to be delivered in 2007. The UAE also has military deals to buy French Mirage jets, British-made Hawk attack aircraft, and four warships from Germany. According to the Interpress service, the UAE has the world's third largest oil reserves and per capita income of $17,000 a year. The UAE is a major investor in the Carlyle Group, the private equity investment firm where President Bush's father once served as senior advisor. That firm is also home to other GOP officials. Bush Administration Treasury Secretary John Snow was chairman of the railroad company CSX. After he left the company, CSX sold its international port operations to Dubai Port World. David Sanborn, former director of Dubai Port's European and Latin American operation, was named by President Bush to head the U.S. Maritime Administration. A new report by the Natural Resources Defense Council concludes that the floodwaters from Hurricane Katrina left a deep layer of sediment contaminated with high levels of arsenic, lead, and petrochemicals, all of which are hazardous to human health. The New York-based environmental group says recent soil samples taken by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency should trigger a toxic cleanup in most of New Orleans and surrounding communities. The NRDC has identified a series of toxic hotspots in residential neighborhoods where contamination levels are 10 times those considered safe for human beings. Previously, the EPA and Louisiana officials had downplayed the health threat to returning New Orleans residents. As NRDC attorney Eric Olson told the Washington Post, quote, "The data they themselves have collected show that, to the contrary, there are significant risks from arsenic and toxic chemicals that have blanketed much of New Orleans. The NRDC study found high levels of arsenic in 95% of the recent EPA soil samples in greater New Orleans, creating a possible cancer risk. Evidence of diesel fuel was found in nearly 60% of EPA samples, and levels of benzoapyrene, a highly toxic hydrocarbon which can cause chromosome damage, cancer, and birth defects, was found in 43% of soil samples. A growing number of pastors in North Carolina are objecting to a request by the state Republican Party for church membership directories for the purpose of outreach and voter registration campaigns. The request, sent by email in mid-February across North Carolina, cited national GOP research showing, quote, "people who regularly attend church usually vote Republican when they vote." The Associated Press reported that the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte rejected the request, stating it does not share parishioners' personal contact information with anyone. Bill Peasley, the chief of staff of the North Carolina GOP, explained, quote, "In doing voter registration, you always go where your base is." during the 2004 presidential election, national religious leaders complained about similar Republican outreach appeals to houses of worship. In contrast, the North Carolina Democratic Party does not seek out church membership lists. As State Democratic Party Chairman Jerry Meeks quipped, "We believe that people go to church for worship and not to sign up for Republican propaganda." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
The February 22nd bombing of the Askariya Shrine in Samarra, one of the holiest sites of the Shia religion in Iraq, set off a wave of sectarian violence that in a week may have killed as many as 1,300 people. In retaliation for the destruction of the Gold Dome Shrine, Shia militias attacked and killed Sunni clerics and destroyed or took over dozens of Sunni mosques. The execution-style murders of men, women, and children, randomly targeted for their religious faith, illustrated the depth of anger and hate that engulfed Iraq over the past week. Government police and the U.S. military did little to stop the violence, but the imposition of a daytime curfew limited the carnage. However, continuing attacks and counterattacks triggered by the shrine bombing has brought the low-level conflict in Iraq closer to becoming an all-out civil war. Shia and Sunni politicians working to form a new Iraqi government abruptly halted their negotiations, but representatives of both sides publicly blamed the U.S. occupation for being, in part, responsible for the bloodshed. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, who discusses the latest wave of sectarian violence in Iraq and the outlook for a withdrawal of large numbers of U.S. troops.
There's a great deal of sensitivity both here in the States and in Iraq among Iraqis about that term, civil war, and I understand why. Iraqis don't want to believe that their country is descending into what that term implies, that sort of one community would take up arms en masse against another, and that national bonds that tie people together of intermarriage and so on would have completely broken down. And that, of course, is not what's happening in Iraq. But there is a civil war, and it is being driven by militias, small percentages of the communities in question, that claim to represent the interests of those communal groups. And so it's very comparable to what happened in Lebanon when there was a disastrous, horrendous 15-year civil war.
Chris, do we know who's responsible for this attack on the Askariya Shrine? And I guess the bigger question is, who benefits from the destruction of that shrine and the escalation of violence?
We don't know who's responsible. In fact, it has been notable that the usual suspects who one might think had done this, the various groups that are rumored to be linked to Zarqawi, the groups that are rumored to be linked to ex-security services men in the old regime. Some of those groups have issued, in fact, communiques saying they did not do this and denouncing it. Of course, across the political spectrum in Iraq, Sunni clerics, Shia clerics, all manner of politicians have denounced this act as intending to stir up sectarian strife. So there isn't really a clear finger pointing at anyone in particular. It's quite clear that whoever did this did intend for sectarian strife to be stirred up and did intend for exactly what has occurred to occur. But one has to start from realizing that the U.S. military presence, the occupation of Iraq, is not the cause, but a major contributor to the sectarian strife in the country. And the simple reason why is that the invasion and the political policies the U.S. has pursued and the diplomatic and military backing, the fact of the U.S. military presence in Iraq, is de facto a prop for the current Iraqi government, dominated as it is by the Shia religious parties and the Kurdish parties. And it is, if Iraq is able to form a new government after the December elections, which it has so far not been successful in doing, chances are the U.S. military will continue to be a prop for a government that is dominated by the Shia religious parties. So So structurally, the U.S. military presence is a form of intervention in a civil conflict that has increasingly taken on sectarian overtones as time has gone by. And what the U.S. can do to quiet down the situation, I think the best thing the U.S. could do, and this may sound paradoxical to some people, but the best thing that the U.S. could do would be to announce a timetable for withdrawal on an expeditious schedule and do so as soon as possible.
If you were advising the Democrats, who are many of them trying to differentiate themselves from the Republicans, not all that successfully, I might add, but if you were advising them on a realistic and sustainable plan for withdrawal of U.S. troops, what would your advice be?
A three-month timetable to be implemented at the soonest possible juncture in negotiation and cooperation with the Iraqi government. It is a sovereign government, but it should not be postponed much longer. It should happen as soon as possible, and this should happen in conjunction with an attempt to have a more comprehensive political process for solving some of these contentious issues that are driving the sectarian strife. Putting that constitutional committee that is supposed to look at possibly revising some of the articles of the Constitution that are problematic, putting that to work as soon as possible would be one concrete step that could be taken. The withdrawal should happen in the context of a national reconciliation conference, such as has been floated by the Arab League. The UN should be brought into that process. The U.S. certainly has to relinquish a lot of its ownership of the Iraq issue on the international stage, either bringing in the UN or the Arab League, not militarily. That's probably neither desirable nor feasible at this stage, but certainly diplomatically. And in such a context, then, if all the political players in Iraq understood that the withdrawal was going to happen, that this irritant and or prop to power would be removed from the scene expeditiously, that might be the thing that would kickstart serious good faith negotiations to heal some of these wounds.
That was Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report. Contact the publication by calling area code 202-223-3677 or visit their website at www.merip.org. On February 24th, the South Dakota legislature passed a bill that bans abortion in all cases except to save the life of the mother. Republican Governor Mike Rounds said he'll probably sign it. The law is a direct challenge not just to the Roe v. Wade U.S. Supreme Court ruling that legalized abortion in 1973, but to legal abortion itself. And that's the point. Lawmakers are counting on the measure if the governor signs it, ending up at the Supreme Court. There, they are hopeful of overturning Roe, since anti-abortion Justice Samuel Alito replaced Sandra Day O'Connor, a swing vote which usually sided with abortion protections. The right to abortion has been narrowed significantly over the 33 years since Roe v. Wade was decided. Restrictions have been imposed, including parental and spousal notification and prohibition of late-term abortions. This so-called partial birth abortion procedure is currently being reviewed by the Supreme Court, despite rulings from three separate appeals courts that banning the procedure is unconstitutional. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nancy Keenan, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, about this latest attack on abortion rights, what her organization is doing about it, and why the issue goes beyond abortion to all women's reproductive rights.
The passage of this ban is really an outrageous attack on women's health and represents a monumental step backward for personal privacy. I mean, this would take us back to pre-Roe v. Wade. It could send doctors to prisons for doing what is in the best medical interest of their patients. And it flies in the face of our freedom as women in this country.
Legalized abortion has fueled the right wing for more than 30 years. And the right has succeeded in chipping away at the law so much that at this point, in many states, there may be just one abortion provider, which obviously makes a mockery of the right to choose. I've heard some feminists say that if Roe v. Wade were overturned, not only would it energize a whole generation or more of Americans who have taken this right for granted, but it could spur legislation that might provide more protection for women than having to depend on the goodwill of five Supreme Court justices.
Well, you have to look at the landscape and what's happening right now in the country. If Roe were overturned, it would go back to the states. That's correct. But we have 19 states right now that already have a ban on the books. So in 19 states in this country, you wouldn't even have a discussion. They have the ban. It's on the books. It's going to go into effect. The rest of the states, we have anti-choice governors, anti-choice legislatures. So what's the chance of us in an anti-choice state of being successful of retaining Roe's protections? That's going to be an uphill battle. Bottom line here, elections matter. Elections matter. And if when we elect these politicians that are anti-choice, because we don't ever think that they're going to take this freedom and this right to privacy away, my message across this country is elections matter.
You've painted with a pretty broad brush. There certainly are some states where abortion is legally protected and quite readily available.
The difference, like California and New York and some of these states that are more progressive, yeah, you might be able to access abortion care in those states, but what does it mean for a woman in rural America that would have to travel somewhere else? But what could happen in the next, let's just say in the next 2 years? The United States Congress, and signed by an anti-choice president, could pass an all-out ban. So whether you live in Connecticut, New York, or California, where you think you're protected and safe and will be able to continue to access abortion care, that may not be the case.
So, Nancy Keenan, how is NARAL focusing its opposition to these attacks?
NARAL's main focus is elections. We are the political arm of the pro-choice movement. And as we're looking at 06, elections in 06, and we're looking at elections in 08, we're going to do everything possible to start electing more pro-choice candidates. Our affiliates across the country, and there are 27 of them, they are looking at legislative seats and governor's races and attorney general races. Again, people don't always vote choice as their top issue. They vote security. They vote their health care. They vote economics, pocketbook issues. And so I think this is a wake-up call that there is more at risk when we vote for candidates who don't share our values of freedom and our values of privacy and our values of making a decision within our family and our doctor and our God, that those folks have to be called out on it, and they don't and should not be elected.
I live in Connecticut, and last year I did a series on the 40th anniversary of the Griswold v. Connecticut decision, the Supreme Court decision back in 1966 that legalized birth control for married women in Connecticut based on the right to privacy, and therefore paving the way 8 years later for the Roe v. Wade decision. And what I learned in doing lots of interviews is that if you scratch the surface of someone who's against abortion, you usually find someone who's also opposed to birth control. How does that figure into your strategy for fighting to protect women's reproductive rights?
You are exactly on the mark that this no longer is about abortion care. The hypocrisy of these people, that they also want to deny women their birth control. They deny trying to advance an agenda that has insurance pay for birth control, pays for Viagra, doesn't pay for birth control. They are advancing abstinence-only education. We all believe young people should be abstinent, but you also have to give them medically accurate sex education. They also, we've seen the politics around the FDA in the morning after pill, and now we're seeing anti-choice legislators pass pharmacy refusal bills, denying women their prescription drug because they have an issue with it. We could prevent unintended pregnancies in this country. If we would do that prevention work, we could reduce the need for abortion in this country. This group is no longer just about abortion care. It is about them wanting to control all of women's reproductive health because of their belief and imposing that, having politicians impose that on us.
That was Nancy Keenan, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Contact NARAL at area code 202-973-3000 or visit their website at www.prochoiceamerica.org. Since the 9/11 terrorist attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C., President Bush has used the power of the White House to authorize extraordinary measures that a growing number of observers believe violate the Constitution and Bill of Rights. Controversial actions taken by the president include the institution of policies that allow for the detention of foreign nationals and U.S. citizens without charge, access to an attorney, or courts. Many prisoners held by the Pentagon and CIA are subjected to torture and abusive practices permitted by the White House. The Bush administration has also secretly adopted a policy called Extraordinary Rendition that permits the transfer of terrorist suspects to nations that employ brutal interrogation methods illegal in the U.S. More recently, the president has admitted to monitoring the phone calls and email communications of American citizens without a court order, illegal under the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Among the groups challenging the Bush administration's actions is the Center for Constitutional Rights. In June 2004, the center won a landmark case before the U.S. Supreme Court that affirmed the legal rights of both U.S. and foreign citizens to challenge their military detention before a judge or other neutral decision makers. But recently, Congress has attempted to revoke that right with an amendment to an anti-torture bill sponsored by Senator John McCain. In another setback for civil liberties advocates, federal judge David Trager recently dismissed a lawsuit brought on behalf of a Canadian citizen, Mahar Arar, represented by the center, who was forcibly taken from the U.S. to Syria by American intelligence agents, where he was imprisoned and tortured. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who outlines the criminal violations committed by the president that he believes are grounds for the impeachment of Mr. Bush. Ratner, along with his colleagues at the center, have just written a book detailing their findings titled Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush.
Well, impeachment is always difficult, even in a house that's controlled by the opposite party. The Constitution requires high crimes or misdemeanors. You don't have to actually have criminal acts to impeach somebody. It's acts that subvert the Constitution. We can just go through them very quickly. One is, clearly, he has an obligation to faithfully execute the laws of the president. He has failed to adhere to the laws and treaties prohibiting torture, failed to adhere to the laws and treaties prohibiting arbitrary and indefinite detention, failed to adhere to the laws regarding disappearances. Violation of those laws is actually criminal in the United States. We have a statute against war crimes. We have a statute against torture. That's number one. Number two, which all your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with because it's been in the press lately, is the National Security Agency warrantless wiretapping scandal. What he did was, despite a congressional law that he actually asked and got amended, despite a congressional law, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, that requires warrants for this kind of wiretapping, despite that law saying it's criminal to do any kind of wiretapping outside of that law, this president, on his own, has signed over the last 4 years 35 separate orders, periods of time, 6 weeks at a time or so, authorizing warrantless wiretapping of American citizens. Clearly, 100%, not only impeachable in the sense of indictable, but this one's a slam dunk in terms of what should be a conviction. All of his excuses for it are nothing but legal sand in our face. There's no question about it. It's a clear line. He's violated a statute of Congress, a serious one that goes to the whole integrity of our constitutional process and our protection of citizens. And the third one, that has to do with the war in Iraq. What he's done there is he's subverted the constitutional right of Congress to decide when this country goes to war. The president went to them and he fraudulently tricked them, fooled them, gave them false information, lied to Congress, lied to the American people about two issues, the weapons of mass destruction, as well as Iraq and its supposed link to 9/11 and Al-Qaeda. Lied day after day, week after week, month after month, and he led us into a war on a lie. So you have those three areas right off the bat. This book contains the four articles of impeachment. It contains the legal analysis written in a way that lay people can understand. And it is important for the American people to understand that this president should not be there anymore. He should be impeached.
In conclusion, Michael Ratner, it seems that so much has been degraded and diluted in our Bill of Rights and in our Constitution in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks on New York City and Washington, that we're now facing a moment of truth here, whether the changes that have been wrought by the Bush administration to the nation's historical and founding documents, whether they're going to stick, and whether future presidents will be unitary executives as newly nominated and confirmed Supreme Court justices like to put it. What is at stake in your view if George W. Bush is not successfully challenged in what he's, in the view of many, subverted in our Constitution and Bill of Rights? What can we look forward to in this country with the actions of future executives in the White House?
What you're really saying, the point is right. You have to hold this administration accountable for torture, disappearances, the Iraq War, and the spying. Unless you hold them accountable through criminal indictment, through impeachment, we will not have a democracy or a republic as we know it. And I think we're close to the tipping point. That is, what's really happening in a broader way is we are seeing a fundamental change in our democracy and in our republic. And sometimes I call it crossing the Rubicon. If you remember when Caesar crossed the river with his troops that turned Rome from a republic into tyranny. And that is what we're talking about. And I don't know if we have very much time to do anything about it. This may be a fundamental change that we can reverse to a certain extent, but we're not going to reverse it all the way unless there's serious accountability against the people who have really subverted our Constitution and destroyed the Republic.
In your view, what's the role of the citizen here? It's not just to read the papers and find out what this or that judge has decided in this or that courtroom. There is a role for citizens, is there not, in this struggle?
Well, I've said this repeatedly. You know, it's really a statement from King. It's really saying that tomorrow is today. If we were looking for the elements of tyranny in this country, it's here now. And so what does that tell us? That tells us that everything that we're doing, which is not just speaking on the radio and telling about what's going on, but everything, I mean demonstrations, protests, every single member of Congress who supports the war, who hasn't asked for impeachment, who hasn't protested the torture and the NSA and the CIA black sites, they ought to be demonstrated in front of their office. They ought to be followed around. There ought to be people sleeping in their offices. I mean, this is not a time to be sitting with our arms folded. That I can tell you. And the problem here is, how do we get people more active? This is it. I mean, we're here. I mean, it can get worse, but sometimes it can get worse where you can't pull it back. And so this is the time for action.
That was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464. Or visit the center's website at www.ccr-ny.org. Michael Ratner is a contributor to the new CCR book titled Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation, too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA needs your membership and your participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll continue during Women's History Month to speak with women about their work to change the world. We leave you now with this quote from Doris Granny D. Haddock. I keep thinking when I get tired that the mission is too big, and what does it matter? Then I think of how my 16 great-grandchildren and all the other children in the country will curse our generation for not trying harder to save our democracy, to have left them a legacy of a neo-Roman empire and a gasping sick earth. And I go out and make another pinprick.